found out about you, except for maybe your blog. Was that what it was? Yeah, and I think I actually asked for permission. Yeah, I think at first you'd written something on your blog, and I asked for permission to republish it on Jesus Radicals. And so when Unclean was coming out, your previous book, I got to write a blurb about how amazing the book was. And it's one of those opportunities where I didn't have to actually lie, you know, because there's always this, somebody asks you to write a blurb, and you're like, well, I better accentuate the positive. But this was a fascinating book to me because someone committed to hospitality, your exploration of how hospitality works within our own psychology of disgust and why we exclude some people was revelatory, because it helped understand the humanness and the humanity behind being inhospitable. Because before I read your book, I kind of thought as people who were inhospitable as just jerks. I didn't understand that there was some rational and psychological reasons for it. And in the book, Richard lays out, it's like you bring together interesting strands of the psychology of disgust, and then Jesus' own way of subverting that by how he worked with the definitions of clean and unclean, and then the implications for that for the church. And so the book Unclean, really, it's in my, I have that little stack of books about hospitality that are really amazing, like Dorothy Day's Loaves and Fishes is on there. And on that stack is your book Unclean, which if you can be on the same stack as Dorothy Day, you're doing something right. So I'm excited to hear what Richard has to say. With that, I'm going to turn the microphone over to you.
Yeah, thanks for having me and being flexible. Let me come in today and jumping right in. And you guys have already been very welcoming to me. And so I'm going to talk about, I know you all have been talking a lot about practices and thinking about social and political structures. And I'm a psychologist. And so and it's also somewhat daunting to talk about hospitality to people that are engaged in radical hospitality. And so in many ways, I am in the place of a student with the witness of y'all in your lives or whatever. And so so insofar as I can say something that might be helpful to you, I hopefully we can do that. But it might be something that it's for those of you that take it back or work with populations that are trying to come along a journey that you're much further on down the road, that can be helpful. So what I'm going to do is talk about the psychology of hospitality, and as Mark alluded to, I'm wanting to talk a little bit about Unclean. And for those of you that have read, how many of you have read Unclean other than Mark? Is there a couple? Okay, well, so I wanted to talk about some of the basic ideas, but if those of you that have read Unclean, I want to kind of shift, hopefully if I can get it all in, to talk a little about maybe practices and lifestyle. And so Unclean is a really good book if you just pick it up. It kind of articulates the problems, the psychological hiccups that we have, the little hesitations in our own affections for other people, but it doesn't do an excellent job of describing what one is supposed to do about that. So I wish I had another crack at the book. If I get a second edition, I might do this material, but you'll get to hear it, okay? So this is the talk is about hospitality is kind of an affectional capacity. Before anything happens, we have to get hearts soft enough to where they would lean into people rather than away. And so I want to describe why that is hospitality is so difficult and then talk about practices related to hospitality. So my slides are being run from the back, so we're going to try to keep these correlated with each other. So let me advance. Can we advance? Okay. I did the research on Unclean because I was at a class one of my friends was doing, who does a missional leadership program in a university, and he said that it's distinctive that the central symbol of Christian worship is a table. The central symbol of Christian worship is a Eucharist. It is, or my communion, we call it communion of the Lord's Supper. So there's this, so central to the Christian imagination of worship is welcome around a table. And obviously that evokes all the things that we see. My apologies. Do I have radical hospitality behind them? We're trying to correlate. this. So obviously, when you think of Eucharist in the table fellowship, you think of Jesus' ministry of radical hospitality, welcoming tax collectors and sinners. Behind me, that's Caravaggio's The Calling of St. Matthew. I don't know if you know that. So Jesus is here. That's the way they dressed in first century Palestine, by the way. That's exactly the way they looked. But Jesus is, you can't see Jesus off on the right. He's pointing to Matthew, and Matthew's kind of pointing at himself like me. So this is in Matthew 9, right? So Jesus calls Matthew, and he takes Jesus back home, and he's eating with Matthew's friends, and the Pharisees come up, and they say, hey, why does your teacher eat with tax collectors and sinners? And Jesus quotes, justifying this kind of radical hospitality that I think is evoked in the Eucharist meal, he cites Hosea 6:6. Go and learn what this means, that I desire mercy and not sacrifice. And that phrase, mercy and sacrifice, kind of becomes the thing that started me as a psychologist thinking through what's going on there. What is sacrifice that's keeping the Pharisees on the outside looking in? They're not welcoming tax collectors and sinners. And what is this thing that Jesus calls mercy? And because clearly these two things are in, you know, tension with each other. And sacrifice seems to go back to, I'm going to keep going one more. The tension between the priestly and prophetic traditions, the purity impulse and the justice impulse. Walter Brueggemann, most of you are familiar with Walter Brueggemann. In the book behind me, you see there, he argues that these two impulses were competing for the imagination of Israel. That is, Israel was having a debate within herself about what it means to be upright or righteous before God. There were kind of two competing messages. The Levitical message was cultic moral purity before God. That's what uprightness was. But yet, all the way through the Old Testament, there's this kind of continual, like, prophetic criticism of that. You know, Yahweh doesn't want your sacrifices. Isaiah, right? What is the true fast that God desires? You know, that's a great passage. The true fast is mercy and justice. And so there are these. So which one trumps? Which one is the way to go? Because they, as Brueggemann argues, they exist in this real profound tension with each other. And you see the Pharisees in Matthew 9, kind of their imaginations have been kind of governed by the purity impulse, the sacrificial impulse, that if you want to be upright before God, you have to have a morally pure community, and you have to withdraw from the unclean. So what they're doing makes sense given that idea. And so Jesus crosses the purity boundary, embraces the unclean, and he cites the prophets. He cites Hosea. What God really wants is mercy, embrace, inclusion, hospitality, rather than sacrifice or purity. So there's this tension there. Now, I was told when I was younger, the way to keep this tension when you got in the world, right, probably one of the more interesting bits of hospitality advice. You remember when, if you grew up in the church, you're going to go out in the world, you're going to be around people that are very different from you are, have different morals, sinners out there, the unclean. And so you're supposed to go out there, and the way you're supposed to balance the prophetic and the priestly traditions in your own life is to do what? What are you supposed to do? Yeah, love the sinner or convert. Yeah, love the sinner, hate the sin. That's the way you walk this tightrope, right? So you're going to be welcoming and embracing of human beings, but you will separate their behaviors and treat those differently. So you'll hate the sin that they're involved in. So my question is, as a psychologist, is like, how easy is that to do? Is that, you know? And I would argue that is extraordinarily difficult to do. It's an easy little bit of advice, but psychologically, how easy is it to kind of marshal up in your gut all this moral outrage toward people without that moral outrage being fundamentally dehumanizing to those people, that you can actually love them with all of your heart at the same time? And I've asked people, I've gone to many different audiences, and I've said, how many of you think that's possible, love the sin, hate the sinner? Most people think it's possible. And then I said, well, give me an example. Like, give me an example of, like, and more often than not, you know what the examples are? I have a brother who is gay, or I have a sister who has a chemical addiction. It's always a family member. It's usually, there is a family member of mine that I see doing something self-destructive, And I hate that self-destructive behavior. That's how they balance it. And I would argue, in the language of Miroslav Volf, what they're showing is an example we'll talk about here later in this talk, is they're showing something that they've already secured in their affections. You know what I'm saying? This is a loved one. This person is already secure in my affections. Therefore, it's okay for me to hate what they're doing because of my deep-seated love for them that can't ever be shaken. The trouble is the church often doesn't get that ordering right. We don't get those deep-seated affections in place first. We actually lead with a moral condemnation, and the ordering is backwards. So more on that in a little bit. So let's talk a little bit about advancing through here. What's going on in the psychology period? Why is it so hard to balance purity and mercy, hospitality and holiness? How do you balance those two? Why is it so difficult? And so what I'm going to take you on here is a little tour, and this will be some of the more this will be one of the stranger 10 minutes of a conversation you've ever had in a church, because I'm going to take you on a little bit of a tour of Discuss Psychology, because if you understand a little bit about Discuss Psychology, I think you'll understand a little bit why it is so hard to balance these two things, and therefore why it is extraordinarily counterintuitive and emotionally difficult and unnatural to be a hospitable person when purity is regulating the way we experience otherness. So let's take a tour of disgust here. And so some of this will be disgusting. It's a professional hazard here. Okay, so let's begin with disgust. First of all, I begin the book in Unclean by asking you to imagine swallowing the spit in your mouth. You can imagine that, right? Just swallow the spittle that's currently in your mouth. That's not very disgusting. It might be kind of weird that I made you think about it. So now imagine this. You can swallow the spittle in your own mouth. Well, psychologists have had people spit in a Dixie cup and then quickly redrink it. Is that disgusting? Yeah, it's a little bit more disgusting. Women find this. Men are like, whatever, I'll drink it. You know, so I never do these demos with college-age males because they'll do anything in front of a crowd. You know, so I don't know what that is about males. I mean, they're just... Right, so the question is, so there's very little physical difference between swallowing the spittle in your own mouth and putting it in a cup and then re-drinking it. It seems, but there's a big psychological difference, and why is that? What's the difference? Obviously, once the spittle crosses the threshold of the body, we don't want to reincorporate it. It's when it's still on the inside, it's okay. So the point here is that purity is inherently a boundary monitoring psychology. Okay, so whenever purity is operating, a boundary transgression is going to be kind of the main thing that you're going to be paying attention to. And in addition, if you hypothetically are eating dinner tonight and you eat something and you find a hair in it, what's your impulse to do? Or if you find yourself eating something that you attributed to be contaminated, you get nauseous and you're going to at least push the food away or send it back, or the nausea response, a vomit response, is expulsion. So the other thing about purity is that that's the way purity is achieved, is the expulsion of the contaminant. So not only are boundaries being monitored, a key, you're going to be hypervigilant about kind of identifying vectors of contamination and expelling that from the inside outward. That's the way purity works. That's why in the scapegoating ritual in Leviticus, the goat, the sins of the are put on the goat, and the goat is spelled out into the debt. See, that's logical. Like, why is that? You know, why don't you just, I don't know, dress the goat up or something? I mean, why is the expulsion of the goat logical to us? Because that's the way purity kind of works. So something has to be expelled. Now, obviously, we're going to get here in a minute. We start applying the psychology to human beings. You can see how that creates an impulse towards pushing away. Okay, beyond, though, boundary monitoring and expulsion, purity is also governed by a series of contamination appraisals. Not disgust actually means in the Latin to taste bad, but not everything that tastes bad is considered to be disgusting. And so there's a set of psychological appraisals that are given that governs how we think about contagion. And so I want to talk about a couple about those because, again, they kind of set up an intuitive rhythm that when they're applied to human beings – kind of sets up inhospitality. So let me give you the first one is obviously proximity. If the contaminant comes in contact with your foodstuff, that contact or that proximity is the location of the causal connection. Now, does that make sense in the realm of food? Yeah, that makes perfect. But so that's the psychology that this is being built on top of. Does that make sense with human beings, proximity or contact? So in the realm of social life, that cause-effect doesn't make as much sense, and yet that's how we reason about it. I mean, there will be people, and you probably know people, that could not stand next to a gay or trans person, like couldn't be in their physical, right? Do you know people like that? No, why is that? Like, why is the proximity? Because we reason about contagion in a magical kind of way. We think the moral issues will kind of like rub off on me. And you think that's silly, but I'll give you another example. I cite this in the book. Psychologists they'll bring people into a laboratory and they'll have like a ratty old sweater, and they'll tell people, they'll say, this sweater was owned by Hitler. Okay? Hitler wore this sweater and it hasn't been washed since he wore it. And would you like to put it on? You know? And most people would be like, no, I don't want, but would you like to take it home? Well, what would it be like? What would it feel like to you to hang Hitler's sweater in your closet, like next to your other clothes? You wouldn't want it. You wouldn't want it to touch it, right? Now, is that rational? Is somehow the evil of Hitler seeped into the sweater, and if you put it on, you feel like it'd like get into you too, or rub off my clothes? It's crazy, but. And yet that's the way we would read. We'd feel uncomfortable. Like, you wouldn't walk up and say, look at this sweater. Hitler owned it. It's, you know, it's like, well, Hitler owned it. That's it's an evil sweater then. No, but it looks great. It accentuates my eyes, you know, whatever. I mean, we don't think about it that way. It's not just another piece of clothing. We think, and we know this even on the playground, right? Kids play contamination games. You guys play contagion games with kids? You know, it was cooties when I was growing up, you know. Or if you guys know the Diary of a Wimpy Kid, you guys ever know the Diary? It's like the new thing out there. So I think it's the stinky cheese touch. Like they passed, somebody touched stinky cheese on the playground, and then whoever was the last person to get touched by that person. So this vector of contamination goes around this little world. My point here is, obviously, when we see, if we were reasoning about morality in purity terms, our natural inclination is to see contact with the immoral or the unclean as a problematic. Contact or proximity is problematic. What is the beef that the Pharisees have with Jesus? It's just simple proximity. You know, just the simple fact that he's with them is the problem. And that doesn't seem to make much sense, that somehow Jesus would be contaminated by proximity. But yet, what I'm saying here is, psychologically, the Pharisees are reasoning about this in a very kind of intuitive way. Another example here, similarity. Psychologists will put like a, we'll get a, I've done this with my students. This is what I get paid to do for a living. I get a clean bedpan, and I'll pour lemonade into it, and I'll ask if they would take a drink. And they know it's a clean bedpan, and they know it's lemonade, but they were like, no, I'm not gonna drink lemonade out of a bedpan. Why? Because it looks like urine in a bedpan. Psychologists have, so just look, even though you know it's not what it looks like, it's just emotionally, it's hard to override that judgment. The psychologists have baked brownies to look like dog feces. And sorry, I told you this is going to be a weird 10 minutes. Did I warn you? I warned you. This is the last time you invite a psychologist back to your conference, you know what I'm saying? This is where we get in the gutter. My friends make fun of me. They're like, you're still talking about your turd brownies. And I'm like, yeah, that's my shtick. But obviously, even if you know if it's a brownie, you still won't eat it because it looks similar to it. And we know this, right? We know don't judge people by their, you know, don't judge a book by its cover. You know, that's the problem. The Pharisees, he looks like, he doesn't look like a holy person, and so we judge people by appearances. So even they look like a kind of person, and so therefore we judge them. The last one I think is particularly significant: negativity dominance. If you take feces and like an apple, and you touch them together, and I've done this with my students, And I'll say, I'll touch them together. Will you eat the apple? They'll say, no, I'm not going to eat the apple anymore because dog poop touched it. It's usually a Tootsie Roll. I don't really bring in dog poop, but they think it's dog poop. And then I say, okay, well, so you won't take the apple. Would you eat the feces then? No. I go, why not? Because if the feces ruined the apple, then the apple should have made the feces very delicious, right? And they're like, no, it doesn't work that way. And that's exactly right. My students are very smart. They're like, oh, yeah, that's logical. They don't do that. This is called negativity dominance, that when the polluted and the pure come into contact, the negative dominates over the positive. Contamination is a one-way vector. It's not two-way, all right? Now, why is that important? Because if we're reasoning about purity in the moment of contact between the church and the world, if you're reasoning about this very intuitively, then the power resides with the world, right? And so, therefore, your only logical option would be to what? You have to withdraw and quarantine yourself. So quarantine and withdrawal is the natural gut instinct, which is why the Pharisees are standing on the other side. It doesn't occur to them. And because, here's my point, it doesn't occur to them because it's unnatural to make this move, that Jesus' presence in the world is a purifying presence. And I would argue that you might, I would say a lot of what you're dealing with in hospitality in any given church is right on that hinge. The counterintuitive reversal that we see all the way through the gospel. We'll go ahead and advance the slide now. Because when you watch Jesus through the gospel, he reverses the polarity of contagion, like the woman with the blood disease. So she's unclean and she touches him, and instead of her making him ritually impure, she's purified. And so to have a church think that their presence in the world as salt and light is actually going to reverse the polarity of contamination is very counterintuitive. It's a capacity that has to be cultivated, is what I'm trying to say. Okay. Let's advance it. So beyond that, beyond the boundary psychology, the expulsive nature of the psychology, the contamination appraisals from proximity to similarity to negativity dominance, disgust also regulates a couple different domains. Core disgust is the root psychological mechanism. That's the food system that we've been talking about. But built on top of the way we reason about food and uncleanliness, we disgust gets imported into these other areas. And so it gets imported into the area of morality. We start seeing sin as contaminants and uncleanliness. And more for our focus will be the top one there, where human beings become vectors of contamination. If I had tons of time, I would spend time thinking about the body and how the body becomes a location of disgust. But I don't think I'll have enough time. Maybe in Q&A we could talk a little bit about how our bodies become problematic in disgust, because the way we receive not just our own body but the bodies of other people is a great deal about, for example, I'll give you one quick example of this, like hygiene. So if you're, obviously many of you work with homeless populations, and so one of the ways you have to welcome hospitality is just master the sensory aspects of dealing with other human bodies and the way they smell and whatever. Because mostly we like to pretend in church buildings like this that we don't have bodies. And by that I mean we spend a great deal of time showering and putting on deodorant. I mean the one thing you don't want to be reminded of that is we all are pretending we're angels, right? That we don't smell or ooze or... You know, but when you encounter a real body, like, they stink. My friend Anthony at the church I worship with, you know, if Anthony doesn't take a shower, he can knock out half that church. It'd be like the church and Anthony, you know, and you hit the door and you're like, whew, you know, it's Texas, it's 300 degrees out there, and you know, if you don't take a shower in a couple of days, but to be hospitable is to go to overcome the natural impulse, and you go, you know, you sit right next to Anthony. And it takes, but that's counterintuitive. It's not what our natural inclination is, to go sit over here, to move away. Okay. More on that a little bit. So I want to talk about disgust in human beings here. How disgust creates a sense of otherness. Obviously, we know through history that contamination and disgust properties have been attributed to almost all despised groups. You guys just had a tour last night. Think about the way the Europeans thought about the Native American Indians and how disgust properties were imputed into that group, and therefore they had to be separated, physically removed and separated. But obviously in Nazi Germany, the Jews were considered vectors of contamination to the purity. In the South, the African American population. You guys have seen the movie The Help, right? You know, and sharing intimate spaces with those bodies, right? So bathrooms become locations of conversation, water faucets, schools, because schools are sacred spaces where our kids are, neighborhoods. So sacred spaces become, we want to remove those bodies from that because they're contaminating. And obviously we see disgust properties attributed to other groups as well, like the LGBT community. Now, my favorite example, my quote of this that I cite is from Levi Strauss, the anthropologist, who talks about how humanity ends at the border of the tribe. Beyond the border of the tribe are these people called infrahumans, or I guess you call it subhuman or dehumanized population. The psychologist is called infrahumanization, where people are, my tribe and my people are considered to be the pinnacle of human society, and these people, because they are have these disgust and contagion properties, are considered to be subhumans. And therefore mixing with them or being in proximity with them. Now, I cite all this, and most of you probably, I'm assuming there's not tons of homophobic racists in the room today. Right, you've come to a hospitality conference. So we're fairly, you know, I'm not doing this. I'm not putting contagion or contamination appraisals on other human beings. So what I want to do is kind of suggest that perhaps you are, and problematize this a little bit. So obviously these examples are extreme, and so we can kind of feel off the hook. I don't do that. I don't use disgust to dehumanize other human beings. So let me talk a little bit about the way this is. Before I get into that, I do want to share some brain research. I wish I had this study before I wrote Unclean. So those of you who read Unclean, this is new. This is a study on disgust and infrahumanization, and you can actually see some brain scans here on the way we reason about or react to despised groups and see them as not as human beings but as objects, as not even. So there's a part of your prefrontal cortex that is activated and involved when we're dealing with social cognition. So if you're trying to figure out how to arrange your furniture in your living room, this part of your brain will not be activated. You with me? But if you're trying to figure out, like, who should sit next to who at your Thanksgiving dinner because Uncle Joe's showing up, you know what I mean? That part of your brain will light up, okay? So when you reason about objects, the frontal cortex doesn't light up, but when you are thinking about human beings and relationships, it does light up, okay? So that obviously we'd like to pay attention to that part of the brain where your brain is thinking about this individual as a human being versus an object, like a chair. So this is what this study did. These are Princeton psychologists. And what they did is they were looking at stereotypes, and they argued, you don't have to buy this theory, but it kind of helps explain what they were up to. They were saying that basically we have one way to think about stereotypes is along a continuum of warmth and competence. The warmth dimension is whether or not you think these people are like affectionate towards you, like they're good people, all right? And competence or capability has to do with their ability to carry through or not carry through on those good intentions. So I can feel good towards you, but if I lack the capability, then although I'm friendly, I can't really do anything for you. So there's kind of like capacity and inclination, okay? Now, these were middle-class people, and so they said the place where you see kind of people who like me and they're willing to help me and they can help me, these were middle-class people, and so they're in that high quadrant. So the high quadrant is your tribe, and for this study, it was middle-class people like myself, okay? And when you see people of your tribe or that are like you, the feeling that goes along with that is pride, right? The, hey, you're my peeps. You're my solidarity, right? Now, there are some people that have the great capacity to help us, but they don't want to help us, like the 1% rich people, right? So for those people, when we see a stereotype of a rich person, the feeling is envy or jealousy or anger, okay? Now, then there's other people that are have great warmth to us, but they lack the capacity to help us. So this might be like the elderly. So they are friendly to us, but they can't really help us I can't make my grandma mow my grass or whatever, you know? So there's just, for their sympathy and pity there. So, but the worst place to be, obviously, is the low. These are people that we judge stereotypically are not interested in helping us. And even if they were, they couldn't help us. And so in this group, in this study, they used homeless people or drug addicts, okay? So in this study, they flashed up pictures of these quadrants, middle-class people like me, and the idea would I'd feel pride when I saw those people. And then when I see rich people, I'd be like, boo, I don't like, you know. And then when I see the elderly, I feel, oh. But when I saw homeless or drug addicts, there'd be disgust and contempt, right? Now, one of the interesting things they did is they also showed pictures of inanimate objects in each of these vectors. Relevant for our purposes, they showed in the low quadrant. Oh, you know, I'm not even showing it. Go ahead and, you guys, I thought you were looking at this behind me. There it is. That's what I'm trying to explain. Oh, thank you. My bad. Y'all see it there? High, pride and contempt. And then when it's high competence but low warmth, those are the envy of the rich people. And then a high warmth but low capacity, pity for the elderly. And then the homeless people and the drug addicts were disgust and contempt. Those are the stereotypical emotions that we feel around these kinds of groups, okay? But in addition, they were showing pictures of inanimate objects from those areas. So for, like, rich people, they would show, like, a Rolex watch, just so, you know, a thing that would signal. And so for the elderly, like a wheel, you know, like a wheelchair or something. Here's what's relevant for our purposes. In the low quadrant, where the homeless and the drug addicts were, they showed pictures of an overflowing toilet and vomit. That's going to be relevant here in a minute. Okay, so when that comes up, you're going to feel disgust, right? Hopefully you're not going to feel pride. you're going to feel disgust when you see those triggers. Okay, why am I showing all that to you? Because, okay, now advance. These are, I don't know if you can see it, this is what brains look like when people are looking at rich people, middle class people, and the elderly. Now, if you look at the bottom there, can you see the bottom? There's a little red circle. You all see the little red circle? That little red circle is the part of the frontal cortex that lights up when you're reasoning about human beings. Okay? So even if you were thinking about or looking at the pictures of people that you typically don't have positive emotions for, right? You might be envious of rich people, but it's still your reasoning about them as human beings. Okay? So I'm going to go ahead and advance the slide. This is what the brain looked like looking at homeless people and drug addicts. If you'll see at the top, there is no little red circle. Parts of the brain lit up, but you'll see across the top, there's no little red circle. Bottom is when they were looking at vomit or an overflowing toilet. And you'll notice that in both cases, that little red circle was not lit up. What does that mean? That means when people were looking at pictures of drug addicts or homeless people, the part of the brain that recognizes them as human beings isn't lit up. Their brains functionally look like, when they looked at a homeless person or a drug addict, their brains looked like they were looking at vomit or an overflowing toilet. That is the neurological signature of dehumanization. Literally, the part of my brain that reasons about these people as human beings is not activated. They are just an object. So that's what we're talking about, dehumanization. Seeing people as, and disgust and contempt are the vectors, are the emotions that signal that is going on. Envy and pity, those are fine. Those are humanizing emotions. But disgust is inherently a dehumanizing emotion. Okay, let's advance. Let's pause. So again, that's pretty extreme. Most of you work with homeless people. And so obviously you don't struggle with that. That's pretty extreme. But one of the things I talk about in the book is that this process of attributing disgust and contemptuous qualities to other people is just a product. It's one of the natural things that happens the way we reason about group membership. What I'm suggesting here is everybody deep in their heart struggles with this. It's just a matter of degree. Okay? Now, how do we know this? Well, in one study, I talk about an unclean. They had people assign in a speed recognition task primary and secondary emotions to in-group and out-group members. So in-group and out-group make sense, right? My tribe versus others. And remember, humanity ends at the border of the tribe. So I'm looking at... And the out-group member could be anything. It could be a different racial group. It could be people in a different nationality. It could be anything. It could be gay, straight, smoker, non-smoker, obese. I mean, whatever becomes a location of stigma has been the target here. It can be PC Mac, okay? Political affiliation, Republican, Democrat, whatever your in-group, out-group is. And they were, as those images pop up, they were watching how quickly it would take for you to assign emotional words to these people. And the two sets of words were primary emotions and secondary emotions. Primary emotions are emotions that we share with other animals. So like a primary emotion is what you share with like a dog, like my dog Bandit. So what's an emotion you share with like your pet? You know, fear is a good one, right? So my dog can be afraid, I can be afraid. That fear does not mark the boundary of the human-animal divide. But secondary emotions are these more higher level, they're quintessentially human emotions. So shame and regret and nostalgia, love. Now, those of you that are animal rights activists will quibble a little bit with that. Like, I think, you know, but the point is we tend to associate secondary emotions to humans and not readily to animals. Hence the justification of using animals for whatever purposes. But here's my point about this. We deny secondary emotions to out-group members. So the reason why a slave mother could be separated from her child on the slave block, sure, she would be sad, right? But not in the way a white woman would be sad, because the white woman, being a full human person, could feel much more deeply in exquisite pain. Do you with me on this? Okay, so it wasn't to say that slave owners couldn't see their slaves sad. I mean, sadness isn't a secondary, it's a primary emotion. Do you with me? So these secondary emotions mark the boundary of what is truly human, okay? What they did in this study is they showed that for out-group members, and again, any slight out-group member, there is a slight hesitation to attribute secondary emotions to out-group members. So if you are a Democrat, you have a hesitation to attribute certain human capacities to the Republicans. Don't you? And you know this. Because there's something wrong with those people, don't you think? Deep in your gut. You know, and if you're a Republican, you have a hesitation to attribute full human emotion to... Because if they really were compassionate human beings, wouldn't they vote differently? You know, if they were really intelligent, wouldn't they? You know what I'm saying? We have this hesitation that we all have. Now, maybe it's a slight hesitation because this hesitation is showing up, you know, with, you know, milliseconds. I mean, this is a speed recognition test. But what I'm saying is that suggests that latent in every heart is a hesitation, is what I'm trying to say. Hospitality is always going to be difficult because there's always this hesitation that just needs an excuse, just needs something to go with it. The inclination is not leads towards but away from people. So we all struggle with this. And this is why I'm talking about an emotional capacity to overcome these kinds of things. Let's advance. Oh, you're already ahead of me. I don't know what's behind me. You guys are like, wow, look at those pictures. Let me give you, stay here with this on this. Another example of this, even if you don't buy this, even if you go, okay, I don't, this whole secondary emotion thing, that's such a subtle thing. Is it subtle enough to be noteworthy? So let me give you another example of where I can... I'm trying to put you on the hook here a little bit. Most of you, though, struggle with feelings, I'm sure, of superiority. Only because they are better. Yeah, only because it's true. Most of us struggle with feelings of contempt or scorn or superiority. Okay? What's interesting about contempt is that it's the same emotional constellation as disgust. It's the same facial recognition. It's the same wrinkling of the nose. In fact, we talk about snobbery is looking down one's nose. The difference is that contempt has a hierarchical component to it. It's disgust directed downward towards somebody who's lower than you are. This is interesting, as I discuss in the book. John Gottman, famous marriage researcher, has done research on divorce. And what he'll do is he'll bring newlyweds into a room and he'll ask them to discuss something that is of tension in the marriage, so a difficult subject. And he'll ask them to just discuss it for like 5 minutes, just talk it through. And they will code the emotions in the exchange. And Gottman, some of his studies have shown 90% prediction success on subsequent divorce by watching 5 minutes worth of interaction between these couples. And so the question for you is, what emotion do you think is most predictive of subsequent divorce? Now, the answer is behind me, so that's the easiest question on the test today. But most people, if I didn't show you this slide, most people probably would have guessed anger. Those people really, if they were angry at each other, that would predict. But you know what's interesting about anger is that anger is actually a fairly egalitarian emotion. You know, you can be angry. Your kids could be angry at you. You can be angry up a hierarchy. You know, you can be angry down a heart. You know what I mean? So it wasn't anger, but it was disgust and contempt. If one of the spouses had contempt, judged by their facial expressions towards the other one, then that was the motion. That disgust and contempt was what predicted subsequent divorce. Why? Because anger isn't inherently dehumanizing, right? But contempt is, because you're disdainful of their... You know, they're stupid. You know, if you think your wife or husband's stupid, then that is their infrahumanization is beginning to take place. So my point is, we all, I think, struggle with contempt and the dehumanizing processes that deal with that. Okay, so let's talk about an emotional capacity. When should I be done? I'm curious. I want to, huh? When? 8 p.m.? Okay, 10 minutes. Okay. All right. So I'm going to tell you, in 10 minutes, I'm going to tell you how to clean all this up here, okay? So what I would like to talk about is like, okay, if basically what I say is hospitality is affectionately very hard, and we all struggle with it day to day. In every interaction, we're constantly sorting people through prisms of contempt or disdain or just... mild revulsion to just like if we're constantly affectionately leaning away from people rather than in, how do we move towards rather than away? What are some practices? So I'm going to share one set of practices that I owe to, so this is the will to embrace that we're talking about. Yes. How do we get to the practice where like Jesus and encounters the leper, and do you guys remember the story in Mark 1? The leper comes and says, "Son of David, would you make me clean if you're willing?" And Jesus says, "I'm willing." And then it says what? He touched him. And I think right there is what we're trying to get at. He touched him first and becomes ritually unclean, enters into solidarity with uncleanliness. And it's only then that he says, "Be clean." And I think the ordering there is everything. It's a different story if Jesus sees the guy far away and says, "Be clean," and approach. I think that touch and the sequencing there is what Miroslav Volf calls the will to embrace. He describes the will to embrace as this. It goes back to what I said at the very beginning. When I say, give me an example of loving the sin and hating the sinner. The will to embrace, the affectional capacities have already been secured with my family member. I can hate their sin because I love them, they know I love them, and I'll never, ever let them go. The trouble is, we get it backwards. We try to get people to get cleaned up, and then they approach. And so the will to embrace is a judgment that Wolf says precedes any other judgment. That has to come first. So how do you get that? How do you create that capacity? So some practices. Now I only have like 6 minutes. Okay. I'm going to introduce you to this saint if you don't know Saint Therese. Does anybody know Saint? Anybody know Saint Therese? If you do not know Saint Therese, let me introduce. Here's how I found Saint Therese. Dorothy Day, right? So I'm researching Christian hospitality. And so if you research Christian hospitality, you're going to eventually stumble upon houses of hospitality. And you start reading about Dorothy Day. And you start like, well, where did Dorothy Day get her? And she was writing a biography of Therese. Considered her, initially didn't like Therese of Lisieux, but eventually considered her to be kind of like a founding spiritual influence on Dorothy Day. Mother Teresa of Calcutta is named after Therese of Lisieux. And Thomas Merton was a big fan. So big hitters in Christianity go to this saint as kind of the way they begin. And you probably already know the little way of Saint Therese because Mother Teresa of Calcutta summarized it very well, right? We cannot do great things, but what? Little things with great love. That's the little way in a nutshell. If you don't know anything about Therese of Lisieux, let me describe her story. She was... She came from a very precocious religious family. Her two older sisters went into the Carmelite monastery late 1800s. So she's a modern saint. She was chafing to get into the monastery, but you couldn't get in until you were 16. And she appealed to the Pope. That's how badly she wanted to get in. The Pope grants it. She gets in at 15, and she just lives the life of a cloistered nun. Never leaves. Never does anything particularly noteworthy. I think when she's 22, she wakes up on Good Friday coughing in the middle of the night, and she notices liquid on her mouth. In the morning, it's revealed to be blood. And through a course of a horrific tuberculosis, within about a year, she's died. So I think she died when she's 23. So for 8 years, she was in the monastery. And then she died. In fact, she lived such an undistinctive and unnoteworthy life from the outside that, kid you not, the sisters of her convent were struggling to figure out who would say anything about her at the funeral. Like, she was nice and kind, but nobody, like, well, that's how undistinctive, ostensibly, her life was. Within about 2 years, she becomes one of the most famous and beloved of the Catholic saints. Becomes sainted, and eventually, I think in the 1990s, becomes a doctor of the church, which is considered to be one of those few saints whose doctrine is particularly noteworthy. So this is up there with like Aquinas and Augustine. She is one of only three, I believe, women that have been given a doctor of the church. I think the other two are Catherine of Siena and Saint Teresa of Avila. So like, the question is, what did she do? So you go from what are we going to say about her to doctor of the church up there with St. Augustine and huge worldwide devotion. What did she do? Well, what happened was before she died, she wrote a memoir called A Story of a Soul, where she kind of describes her spiritual journey. But one of the things she describes in this memoir, the thing that captured the imagination of people like Dorothy Day, was what's called the Little Way. What she wanted more than anything, Therese, was she wanted to do something great and heroic for God. She wanted to be a priest, but couldn't. She wanted to be a missionary, but couldn't. She wanted to not only be a missionary, but die a martyr on a missionary field. But she was a cloistered nun. She just did what many of us do in a day, right? Which is do laundry, do the dishes, and cook meals, and try to get along with the people in my life. Like every day, day in, day out. That's what she did. Just get along with the people in her daily life. And so she wrote in The Story of a Soul, she described something she called the Little Way. And I would like to unpack it for you here right now. I'm going to describe this very quickly as a series of practices called that involve approaching, attention, interruptibility, honoring, and seeing. I probably won't get through all this. So we'll just start. Maybe I'll get through this first one. And we can stop. This is what the little way is. This is the way Therese described it. She basically said, okay, here is my heroic path to Jesus in the ordinary daily stuff of life. How do you welcome and show hospitality in the dailiness of life. She said, you know what you do? When I look around in my day, there are people I'm naturally drawn to, and I want to spend time with them because they're popular and they're funny and they're witty. And then there's these other people in my life that I'm like, ugh, when I see them coming, I'm just not drawn to them. And she said, this is what she describes the little way. She goes, I have noticed, and this is very natural, that the most saintly of the sisters in her monastery are the most loved, right? The most well-adjusted, the most kind and are loved. We seek out their company. We render them services without their asking. And finally, these souls that are so capable of bearing with the lack of respect and consideration of others see themselves surrounded by everybody's affection. The rich socially get richer, right? But she goes, but on the other hand, imperfect souls are not sought out. No doubt we remain within the limits of religious politeness with these people, but we generally avoid them, fearing lest we say something that would not be too admirable. So this is how she describes the little way. So when I speak of these imperfect souls, I don't want anybody to speak of spiritual imperfection, since most holy souls will be perfect in heaven. But I want to speak in these people of a certain lack of judgment. I'm sure people come to mind right now for you. Or good manners, a touchiness in certain characteristics. All those things which make life not agreeable. I know very well that these moral infirmities are chronic and that there is no hope of a cure. Right? Some of these people are so socially awkward, you're just like, that's not fixable. Okay? But she goes on to say this, but I know that my mother would not cease to take care of me and try to console me if I remained sick my whole life. And so this is the conclusion I draw from this. So here's a practice. This is the little way in a nutshell. I must seek out in recreation on my free days the company of the sisters who I find least agreeable. That's a practice. Wake up every day and go. See, this is why it's a pretty heroic path, you know. It's easy to kind of think grandly and heroically, but there are certain people in our lives that we're not going to be attracted to. Seek out the person who is least agreeable in order to carry out in their regard to these wounded souls the office of the Good Samaritan. She describes just going up to these people as being like the Good Samaritan. She goes, a word, a kind word, an amiable smile will often suffice to make a sad soul bloom. So I want to be friendly with everybody, and especially with the least agreeable sisters, so that I might give joy to Jesus. So I could go on, but one of the things that the little way is a practice of hospitality is that daily practice of moving towards rather than away. When all of our psychology is telling us, don't approach, stay away. I could go on and read. One of the things she talks about is how in the monastery, these unagreeable people, she would detour around them. You know, she would see them coming and go. Do you guys detour around people? Right. I detour around people in church, you know. I mean, I like see them coming like, not today. I just can't do it. I can't do it today. I got to go to the restroom right here, you know, and just take a detour, you know. And that's one of my practices last Lent. I wrote this on my blog. One of my practices last Lent was a no-detour rule. I promised for 40 days to give if I see somebody coming, I'm going to walk right up to them. I'm going to say hi. And now you might say, that's a weird little practice, and that's not a big deal. But what's amazing about that is that that creates, if you practice that every day, if you go to where you would not normally go, if you say hello and just give a smile and an invitation to places you would not normally go with people, it changes you. And it brings you into relationship with very surprising people. So let me end with this. This is how it's happened. This is what happened to me. So I said to myself, okay, if I was going to practice the little way in my church, I kind of looked at my church congregation and go, where's the one person I probably would not, where would be the last person I would be drawn to? And I saw Christy. And if you know my blog, you know stories about Christy now. But Christy is... She sat in the back wall. She's in a wheelchair. And that's, you know, people are in wheelchairs, we feel awkward, we don't know what to do. So she's handicapped. Plus, she's blind. She has these big glasses, so you can't see her face, so you can't see her eyes. And half her face is paralyzed. The reason why she lost her eyesight, I found out she had a tumor. And when they removed the tumor, she lost her eyesight. But that's paralyzed half her face, and she can't smile now. And if you can't smile, you look sinister. It's the same way if you work with homeless populations. Lots of people have lost their teeth. And they look scary, aesthetically speaking, but it's just because they don't have any teeth. But when they, you know them, they're happy people, but they don't look happy because the teeth are missing. Christy just, so she just kind of had a real scary kind of appearance. And I was like, I don't feel intuitively drawn to her, but I'm going to approach. And so I started every day at church, I made sure I visited with Christy. And one day I said, hey, Christy, why do you always sit here on the back wall? And she's like, well, when the van picks me up, they just wheel me back in the back wall because our church wasn't very wheelchair accommodating. You know, it blocks the aisle. So we can talk about the hospitality space here for a minute, but we won't. And she goes, I go, would you like sitting back here by yourself? She goes, no, I'd like, because sometimes people step on my feet. I'm like, that's awful, you know? I mean, so we're putting the blind girl, and we're stepping on her feet. I'm like, this is the worst thing ever, you know? Like, that's the way we welcome in my church, you know? And I was like, well, I said, would you like to sit with us, my family? She goes, oh, yeah. And so we figured out a way to do it. So Christy sits with my family now, and I visit Christy every week at her assisted living facility and took her shopping for her birthday a little while back, and she wanted some new sunglasses, and she can't see, but she wanted rhinestones on her sunglasses. And I was like, well, and you know why she wanted rhinestones? She can feel them. Yeah. So we got the biggest blingy sunglasses, so she's in her wheelchair, these big sunglasses, and she likes them. And so here's my point, is that's a little tiny story to end with. But I got there because of the little way. I get to that place because I'm like, what is the, where people say, you've described a great job of how we struggle with hospitality. What are we going to do? How are we going to change the world? How are we going to become more hospitable? I'm like, well, there's probably one person in your life today that you can welcome. So start there. And I'll conclude. Thank you for having me, and we can take some questions. I went a little over, but thank you.
If you have questions, raise your hand, and I'll pass this to you.
Does anybody have any questions?
See, this is kind of looking at it from the backside, but I was wondering if the psychology of disgust, how this would explain something I've watched and seen happen a lot. Several times a year, I create like a bus tour of Minneapolis, mm-hmm. and it's for people who have never hardly been in the city, never been around diverse populations, never used public transportation.
Yeah.
And one thing that I always hear from every group is, I was really surprised how nice people were. And I was just wondering if that psychology of disgust addresses that aspect of, I mean, people were expecting to be disgusted, expecting people to be mean to them, and instead they found people that helped them find the bus, and they watched people help each other get on the bus, so it's kind of a sideways.
Yeah,
question,
yeah, that's, yeah, yeah. So they were expecting one thing, but they actually found a great
and
they, deal.
Oh, I get that from every group. Yeah, yeah. I was so surprised how nice people were.
Yeah.
They received niceness, or they witnessed it.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of us that work with very marginal populations know that. You know, the degree of kind of community and helpfulness. And I know people of my acquaintance that give money. They don't have any money, but they give it away, you know, because somebody else is. The only thing I'd say is I think it just gives an example of how people aren't humanize, they're judging through a filter and therefore not really encountering a real human being. But when they do, they're surprised. And it probably is crashing through clearly their impressions have been interrupted by the humanity of these people. And so I think it just illustrates the filter that we're constantly... but you're going to have to need human contact before those things can be dealt with. And it activated a part of their brain probably. And the other thing about contact is the contact, psychologists that have worked with groups that are trying to cross a stigma boundary, mainly this is with race relations, that the best way to decrease prejudice is that you have what's called cooperative egalitarian contact. If the contact is still hierarchical or charity-based, it still just reinforces stigmas. Does it make sense? Well, I'm encountering the other, but the other is getting a handout. But if it's cooperative, we're working on a common shared goal and egalitarian, everybody's that reduces prejudice. Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. No, it's a great comment. Other questions or objections? Or we can go back to the dog feces. I'm good on that subject. Over here.
I'll just say one of the most helpful things that someone offered to me, and it goes along, I think, with the kind of the, what you're saying, humanity doesn't extend beyond the group. Mm-hmm. That idea is the notion that people make sense, they just don't make sense to me. And it's the idea that, you know, we tend to judge other people on our terms and through our filters. Mm-hmm. And so if someone doesn't have our lifestyle or our cultural beliefs or political backgrounds, we rationalize it through our lens rather than through theirs, you know. We don't, we project our circumstances onto them rather than saying there's a reason this person is Democratic or Republican, there's a reason this person is poor or rich, there's a reason, and we don't put ourselves in their place. But when we do that, we humanize them and we extend our compassion because we withhold our judgment by projecting ourselves onto them. And so, you know, I'm in a mental health therapist, and so I work with lots of different clients from all sorts of different backgrounds, and it would be very easy for me to project my lens, mm-hmm. you know, onto these people and to judge their behaviors as, you know, mentally ill or all those kind of things. But this perspective has allowed me to say, well, there's a reason anybody that comes to my office, whatever their struggle is, there's a reason. Mm-hmm. For me to have compassion, I have to try to make sense of why they are the way they are.
Yeah.
And at the same time, analyze why am I the way I am. Mm-hmm. If I'm judging them and condemning them and being disgustful towards them, you know, that's more about me than it is about them. And how mm-hmm. can I extend that compassion in that way? So that's been a really helpful frame for me. Doesn't mean I always do it, but
no.
When I do it, it is helpful. So,
and so I think key there is to figure out ways we can create context where those stories get told. Because if I don't hear your story, then it's hard for me to feel empathy. But when I hear your story, even if I disagree with you strong, if you tell me your story, then, which is why I think table fellowship is so critical. I think, if you know, I've talked about the little way, but, you know, the fundamental practice is table fellowship. I mean, that's the way Jesus did it. And so when Jesus said, you know, as often you do this, you know, and I don't think he was talking about the Eucharist. I was thinking, like, when you get together and you break bread, like in any context, you know, tell my story. I think, I think when you look at Acts 2, Acts 4, when they say they broke bread, I think that was their common agape meal is what they're talking about there. The Eucharist was a part of that, but I think table fellowship is where stories, life gets shared. So there was another, yes.
So, you know those quadrants.
Yeah.
So when people see others as non-human. And then let's say you practice the little way or something like that, then would it move to then pitying them? And then, or has there been like a study, like kind of like what phases it moves to? And then does this approach help, you know, move along that spectrum, I guess?
Well, I mean, I can't say that. I mean, I would think that would be the trajectory that you would travel. You know what I mean? But that would be hypothetical. I would think you can make a good case that you would move from disgust to pity, and then from pity to kind of full kind of humanity. I mean, I think that would be, Joe, does that make sense? I think that would be the journey you would travel. But whether or not there's treatment outcome data on a group of people who have tried the little way, if they've actually made that journey, I don't know of any data that's been done like that. But it would be a great study to kind of, I mean, it could be done. I mean, are you a social psychologist? Because you could do that study.
No. No, but I'm just wondering, like, if
it could be done. I mean, that's a straightforward study.
That would be neat to see, like, if someone practices the little way, to see how their brain changes, hopefully they would see the other as more and more human, and you'd see different things lighting up. And
I would think and I think many of us would probably tell in our own biographies that we've made journeys like that, you know. And maybe you weren't explicitly practicing the little way, but you have been engaged in some sort of contact and therefore have traveled an emotional journey where initially I had revulsion towards people, and then I started feeling compassion for them and pity, but now you move from, you know, a good example of this is, who wrote that book called Friendship at the Margins, you guys know? I still struggle with describing, because here's one of the things I struggle with is, and I struggle with this on my blog a great deal, is like I want to tell stories of what's going on in my life, about the journey I'm on. I haven't arrived. I'm just, you know, a neophyte when it comes to a lot of this stuff. But I want to write stories that kind of help other people, but I also don't want to write stories that kind of objectify. Like I told a story about Christy. I feel very ambivalent telling you that story. It's a great story, but in many ways I've objectified her to make a good point. Maybe make you think I'm a good person. Does it make sense? So how do you talk about friendships? Yo, thank you. Thank you. You feel contempt for me. But does it make sense, though? Like my church does a horrible job at this. And so I'm sure this is a great church and you don't do anything like this. But like my church, like we were doing our community offering. This is an example of pity to full humanity, okay? Like we were showing, we take up an annual contribution for all the meals we serve to people. And the church that I go to is called Freedom Fellowship. You know, all these outreach ministries. And so, you know, what churches do is they'll take video footage and pictures of these events, right? And so then you show those pictures to the largely, fairly, in this case, white audience. And they look at those pictures and they feel, oh, look, you know, the Hispanic mom shopping in our Christmas store. Or, you know, there's the African-American man going through the food, you mean, and we donate. But here's the thing. Those people go to our church. Like they're in the audience as the videos are playing, you know, and it's not framed in a bad way, but it's just a kind of weird thing, right? You're showing. Why are you showing my picture today? Because I'm the one that's going to be the object of your donations, that insidious objective. But I mean, what you call them? Charitable organizations overseas, you know, I mean, how do you promote empathy but not objectify and use? So I got up that day and I said, I'm supposed to lead the prayer here, but I just want to say that lots of the people we've seen on this video are like friends of mine. And until we get to that point, move out of pity to seeing these as friends who have something to contribute, not just receive from us, then we've arrived. But I fall in that trap all the time. So I do think that's a hard journey for us to make. I think a lot of good Christian people get trapped in the pity quadrant. And that's not the worst place to be. Does it make sense? I mean, it's not the worst place. But yeah, I think we get stuck there sometimes. I rambled. I apologize. I'm a college professor. This is a professional hazard. And I'm immune. You can fall asleep on me. Like, I lecture in front of 200 freshmen. You can all fall asleep on me. I won't care. I'll just keep talking. I'm like the Energizer Bunny. That's what I do for a living, is talk to bored people. Anybody, there's a hand back here? And I don't know when we end, so I'm going to leave it to the conveners to cut this up. Okay, all right. Oh.
Yeah, it's not really a comment, or not really a question so much as a comment.
Go ahead.
My wife and I experienced being poor, and I recommend that, especially if you're younger, live your life so that you've given enough away that you're poor, so that when you're helping others, you can help them with an honest experience saying, hey, we've received help, and now we're helping you.
Yeah.
I know that we experienced watching others whom we could not, at the time, repay. Mm-hmm. And I honestly can pass it on. And especially if you're young, don't concentrate on your own wealth at first. Really make an effort to share so that maybe you... My father-in-law used to say this, and I thought it sounded stupid at the time, but he'd say, give until it hurts. And then you'll see the grace of God. And I thought he was just talking about in a financial way. But there's ways where we've experienced that. And that we didn't stop there. Mm-hmm. We've moved on, and hopefully we've shared, you know, after moving on in our financial journey, and granted, I know we've had it easier than many, but we can honestly say, look at our pictures of when we borrowed a 20-year-old car to go on vacation. Mm-hmm. And here, do you want to borrow ours like we borrowed somebody else's or something like that? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. You know, yeah, I think... but, I mean, I think that's where the whole tradition of... That phase of life, I mean, your point is we went through that phase of life just by the developmental sequence of our lives. So what if somebody hasn't had that developmental sequence? Then they're going to have to be intentionally practicing. And that's where I think witnesses of, like, intentional communities, voluntary poverty, those, you know, I'm sure lots of y'all's community can speak to those kinds of practices where Dorothy Day would call it precariousness. It's not necessarily poverty. It is feeling vulnerable. And so she talked about kind of stepping into precariousness. That's a radical practice that judges me in a great deal. But it goes to your point that insofar as I have experienced precariousness, and that's one of the things I could have talked about in the book, is the degree to which we feel like we're vulnerable, needy people. So my example is in the other place Jesus says, I desire mercy, not sacrifices, in Matthew 12. When the disciples are collecting grain in the field, they're hungry, and the Pharisees judge them, and they say, "What are you, you know?" So they can't see the hunger of those people. And Jesus gives an illustration later, and he says, "How many of you, if your sheep fell into a ditch, wouldn't go in and go after it?" Well, the sheep wasn't like a pet. It wasn't like, "Hey, Fluffy, your pet fell into the ditch." What's the sheep represent? It's an economic illustration. You know, he's saying, if you lost your job, if you lost your paycheck, would you not go, you know what I mean? And so he's basically saying to the Pharisees, because you do not recognize your own vulnerability, so I pointed out to you, you could lose something. You can lose your own job and your insurance. And when you realize that, then you might worry about giving other people, you mean? It's because we think we're invulnerable or materially buffered that we lack empathy. Then everybody else that's poor is just a shirker or a wanting, you know what I'm saying? So I think it goes to your point that the experience of our own need and vulnerability increases empathy. Yes.
Well, that's right. I was thinking about what Daryl said, and so I have two little boys at home. One's just about, he's like 2.5. The other one's 5 months old. And the 2.5 month old, I live in Southern California, and everyone's like, you should get that kid modeling, because he's gorgeous, and he's got these huge blue eyes, white blonde hair. We're hanging out in Old Town San Diego, and this huge group of these little Chinese kids just surrounded him, and they all had their tablets, like, taking pictures of him, because he's so weird-looking to them, I think. but my four-month-old is in need. He's got a misshapen head. Okay. There's a flat spot, and he's going to have to wear a helmet, and my wife's completely horrified. She's a designer, you know, very aesthetic, like,
yeah.
And having a kid wearing a helmet is horrifying. But I was, you know, I'm wondering about, if you have any idea, the sort of, when you're looking at the disgusting sort of people,
yeah,
if a person was homeless, kind of getting to Daryl's point, if a person was homeless, if they're looking at that same picture, do they see them as disgusting, or do they see them as a human? And thinking about how do I, especially in, like, my very attractive little boy, you know, in elementary school, like, a lot of people thought I was disgusting for whatever reasons. But how do I, you know, thinking about that sort of experience deeply shaped my ability to be at this conference, even, I imagine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what is there some way of finding humanity by being with those, you know, or being that very thing? And I'm wondering if you could comment on that.
Yeah. I mean, that's a very well-known bias in the social psychology. It's called the what is beautiful is good effect. Are you guys aware of this effect? people who are beautiful are rated as more intelligent. Well, they're rated on better everything. They are, yeah, like, that's why Mark is so, I think you, he's such a handsome man. No, I mean, people who are beautiful are rated not only as more intelligent, but better human beings, like more virtuous. So it's just an aesthetic bias that may it probably has some adaptive value to be attracted to symmetry. You know what I'm saying? It's shy, you know. Sure, you can make a Darwinian reason that we're attracted to genetic, good genetic stock or whatever like that. But it creates this what I'm saying, these flashes of affective feelings that we don't realize that we're experiencing. And that's kind of why I describe Christy. You know, when you see handicap or disability or a kid in a helmet or whatever. Now, for those of you that have lived with siblings or family members or people that have disabilities or special needs, know that, you know, that story would hit your button. You should be like, because I have, you know, my child was in a world, you know. So yeah, I think the little way suggested it would be that if we find we have those strong reactions, and we all vary in the degree to which handicap and disability and deformity affects us. Everybody has different thresholds of disgust, where you might be fine eating gum off the floor. Some people, people vary. But handicap might hit you in a weird spot. Maybe your history or whatever. So some people might, that's a trigger for you, handicap or mental retardation, or then I think the little way would say you go to those places. And this is where, like, Jean Vanier's community, but the L'Arche community, living with handicap is the way to go. So maybe you volunteer in places, you know, or whatever. Because that's the only way to do it, is to, you just have to reshape your affections by learning stories and their histories and humanizing them. There's no quick way to do it, you know.
I have a couple of quick comments or questions here, and then I'm going to wrap it up for now, and we're going to move shortly into our next session with the panel, and then we'll have a chance to ask more questions and engage as well. But one, and if we don't have time to answer these right now, we can do it in the next section. One question I have is, in this research, the psychology of disgust, how much sort of cross-cultural differences has this research been done? I'm thinking, sometimes we talk about here in this church, like, the history of the legacy of Western dualism and Plato, mm-hmm, and the sort, mm-hmm, of idealism piece and the world of the forms and the ways that continues to shape the West a bit, and its legacy, and has also been behind various forms of colonial domination and things like that, in the ways that we've categorized folks, white, mm-hmm, and black, and, you know, civilized, uncivilized, those sort of things. So if that also is an element here, a sort of cultural shaping or socialization in the way that we understand these things. Mm-hmm. So that's one question. The second comment is on Jesus. When we think about Jesus as the one who crossed these barriers and who was with tax collectors and sinners and things like that, the story that always comes to mind when I'm thinking about that is the Syrophoenician and the Canaanite woman. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. As an example of, on the one hand, my hesitancy with that is lifting up Jesus as this heroic figure who does do this,
right,
work, and also recognize that he himself seems to have had a few of the prejudices of his culture, society. And when I think about Christology, then it's his ability to be checked in that moment, mm-hmm, to receive, and then to let that be a part of him. And so if I think about Jesus, then the Syrophoenician woman is a part of Jesus' embodiment from that point forward,
yeah,
in the way that he's relating to others around. So it becomes a communal element, and not just Jesus as this heroic, mm-hmm, male who goes forth doing all these things. So,
yeah,
a couple of comments.
You know what's interesting about that? You guys know Luke Timothy Johnson, Catholic, New Testament theologian? He was on our campus last week, and he made a crazy comment. He goes, a lot of liberal, progressive Christians love Jesus, hate the church. And he goes, but one interesting thing about it was the church was more hospitable than Jesus. And I went, what? And he goes, Jesus welcomed unclean Jews. The church welcomed Gentiles and expanded the moral circle. And the critical contagion event there is Acts 10, unclean animals. And God rewires Peter's disgust boundary. And he goes and he crosses into another nation. And he said the church was hospitable in ways that Jesus struggled with, you know, which is you don't typically give the church kudos for being more radical than Jesus, but it's a really interesting, it's an interesting move, you know, coming on your point there, so.